Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. If you listen to the little promo at the top of the hour, I said this doesn't really have anything to do with Halloween, and I was wrong. Occult America, the secret history of how mysticism shaped our nation, does have something to do with Halloween. Among many other things, author Mitch Horowitz, in his History of American Mysticism, notes that the occult is so much an enduring legacy that Halloween may soon become a recognized religious holiday within the U.S. military. Luckily, Mitch Horowitz, who also is the Tartar Penguin editor-in-chief, is with us today to talk about the book and what the deal is with Halloween. Thanks, Mitch, for joining us.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Right off the bat, I mean, could you just tell us a little bit about your background, what led you to writing the book in the first place?
Oh, sure. You know, when I was a kid growing up in Queens, New York, there was really a feeling that the occult was just everywhere in the air. You know, you would turn on the television and there was Merv Griffin or Mike Douglas interviewing an astrologer or a psychic or a robed guru. And we would gather in basements to use Ouija boards and swap ghost stories. And I fondly remember my sister reading the books of Carlos Castaneda. And there was just this flowering of paranormal and esoteric material everywhere you looked. And I kept asking myself, even as a kid, where did this stuff come from? I knew it all had roots. It didn't just drop from the sky or grow from the ground yesterday. And I was less interested in reading newspaper horoscopes, although I did some of that too.
I still read mine. I'm sorry. It's like, it's true confessions now.
The guilty pleasure. One has to fess up. But whenever I would encounter that material, I would always ask, gee, where did these arcane symbols come from? And, you know, how did my personality get associated with the stars in this belief system? And as I got older and entered adulthood, without coincidence, I became a publisher of New Age and metaphysical and occult books. So my interest and my immersion in the field continued into adulthood, and I began to notice great differences between the American occult and the European occult. The American occult had more of a self-help and practical orientation, and as I saw it, had really exported so many ideas around the world and come to color our nation in so many very subtle and unseen ways. And I wanted there to be a serious history of the occult as a religious movement, as a community of belief, which is really what it's been in its various forms since the founding of America. So I wrote Occult America because I thought there was a great gap in our religious history. We had never thought about and understood occult movements as serious religious movements or communities of belief.
Mitch, I don't want to interrupt our train of thought, but you may be holding the phone too close to your mouth.
Oh, okay.
And it's
no problem.
That may be what's creating the static that you hear. I don't know if you hear it or not, so I apologize.
Oh, I don't hear it, but okay. I can fix that.
Thank you. At the very top on the cover of the book, Ken Burns writes this. Ken Burns. He says, "What a fascinating book. It happens that another equally compelling take on our complicated national narrative lies just beneath the surface of things. And really, you do sort of follow the history of the country. Well, before it was even a country."
Yes.
And,
it's interesting. You know, I mean, America had this reputation for religious experiment even back in the colonial days. That was not only pre-Aquarian age, but it was pre-Constitution, pre-American Republic. You mm-hmm. know, as early as the 1600s, the American colonies had developed a reputation as a place where people of radical or unusual religious beliefs could find safe harbor. It's really, you know, that string of religious experimentation extends way back, you know, even to the earliest days of the Republic.
Yet many of them still were tied to Christianity.
Yes, it's very interesting. That was a unique aspect of the American occult. You had folks in this country, for example, in the mid-19th century, there was a craze called spiritualism, which involved talking to the dead and forming into seance circles, communicating through spirit raps and trance mediums. And if you asked most spiritualists, well, what's your religion? They would say Methodist or Lutheran. There wasn't a sense among Americans, and there never really has been, that participating in occult or arcane methods or practices required leaving the faith of one's childhood or leaving the congregation one belongs to. You see this pattern repeat again and again in America, whether people are into some kind of mind power mysticism or divination or spiritualist methods. They really had no problem interweaving that with their identity as Christian.
So a cult per se, maybe we need a good broad definition, but one thing that people often attach to the word occult is sort of witchcraft or dark magic and that sort of thing. Can you give us a good definition and how those ideas are compatible or incompatible?
Sure thing. You know, it's interesting. They're really, one of the things I write about in the book is that there really never has been a tradition of any kind of Satan worship or black magic in the West. Those were epithets that really grew out of late antiquity when the early church was in a struggle with paganism for dominance over the Western world. And the church characterized pagan worshipers, participants in nature religions and such, as practitioners of something called black magic or Satan worship. Those worshipers never saw themselves that way, and in fact, there's never been any such tradition in the West. It's sort of a string of epithets that got imagined into a tradition. Occultism simply comes from the Latin word occultus, which means hidden or obscure. It entered the English language during the Renaissance when a Renaissance scholar named Cornelius Agrippa wrote a three-volume book called Occulta Philosophia. And Agrippa was interested in rescuing some of the prophetic and esoteric practices from the ancient world that had gotten lost during the Dark Ages. So he created this massive compilation, this encyclopedia of spiritual and occult and divinatory practices that had flourished to some extent in late Egypt, in the Roman Empire, in ancient Greece, and he called these by the term occult. That was the very first time we began to associate these things with that word. And occultism had a great flowering during the Renaissance, but it's a spirituality that's always stood apart from any particular doctrine or church or congregation. And so in that sense, it's always come under a kind of suspicion.
When Agrippa went to compile all of this information in that, it was a three-volume study, was there any sense about how much had been lost during the Dark Ages?
No, you know, I mean, it's interesting. In the late 1400s, for the very first time, some Greek Egyptian texts, magical texts and manuscripts were rediscovered. There was a Byzantine monk who wandered into the royal court at Florence in the year 1460, and he had with him some manuscripts that had this funny, mysterious name on them. The name was Hermes Trismegistus, or Thrice Greatest Hermes. That was a name of honor that the ancient Greeks gave to Egypt's god of writing, Thoth. So there were some Greek Egyptian ideas that were just coming to light at the threshold of the Renaissance that probably stemmed from Alexandria, probably stemmed from the late stages of the Egyptian Empire. And people were very aroused and excited by this because they thought, wow, this stuff is older than Christianity. This is some kind of primal religious philosophy. That was something that excited the Renaissance mind. But it's difficult to get our arms around just how much could have been lost. You know, it's just speculative. We have so little in the way of Egyptian or Greek-Egyptian manuscripts. It's just a precious trickle that was preserved. So Agrippa was dealing with some of that material. He was also dealing with Arab texts from late antiquity because Arab scholars around the 8th, 9th, 10th century also managed to preserve some of the ancient Greek-Egyptian ideas. So that's how they've reached us.
You mentioned earlier that sort of the standard bearers of American occult took a different path from their predecessors toward the public good and self-help. Back in the 17th century when they were burning the women at the stake,
yeah,
accusing them of black magic and being witches and that sort of thing, were they part of the movement but just not part of in the way that they were perceived by the I don't know what you want to call the people who did that, but
yeah,
the crazy people.
Right. Well,
how eloquent is that?
Well, anyone, you know, it's interesting. In Europe, these witch trials and witch hunts, they went on just for centuries. You know, they extend back to the Middle Ages, and they, you know, these things were still going on. Some of these murders were still going on. Gosh, in Switzerland, as late as the 1790s,
really?
Well into what we call the Age of Enlightenment,
mm-hmm,
a rural housemaid was tortured and beheaded on charges of being a witch. So, you know, really for a period of centuries, throughout what we call the modern era, various pockets of Europe were engaged in witch crazes. And just countless numbers of people, most of them women, were accused, tortured, and killed. And in most of these cases, I don't think there was any kind of occult practice whatsoever going on. You know, again, the idea of a black magic or Satan worship, to an extent, was a fantasy that grew out of late antiquity when the pagan powers and the early church were involved in a struggle of ideas. And the winners got to call the losers names, and among those names were witches or Satan worshippers. So to a very great extent, that was a fantasy of the modern mind, and it resulted in this tragedy, this catastrophe of witch hunts that really spread throughout Europe and would kind of go underground and then erupt again for centuries. Here in America, we really had one well-known instance of that, which were the Salem witch trials in the 1690s. Now, Salem was a tragedy on par with what had happened in Europe, but it was also an exception. I mean, in Europe, for generations and generations, this stuff was going on. In America, there was this spasm of mob violence that broke out, and as tragic as it was limited. It was isolated. It's not that there weren't other instances of violence against minority religions in America, but by and large, that was a gaping exception. So that's one thing that marks a difference between occult history in America and Europe.
We have a minute before our next break, but tell us about the Occult America walking tour that you did this month. What was that about?
We had an occult walking tour of New York City, and New York is thought to be the city of commerce, but in fact, there's a great deal of occult history in New York State and New York City, and we took a walk through Midtown Manhattan, where, for example, there is a Swedenborgian church that's a mystical movement that flowered in this country in the 18th and 19th centuries, still exists, and this Swedenborgian church was presided over by a minister named George Bush, who is a first cousin four times removed from the Bush presidential clan, and he was a spiritualist. Different aspect of the Bush family history in America.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We are speaking with
Mitch Horowitz.
I'm sorry, Mitch.
That's all right.
I just lost my place. Mitch Horowitz, he is the author of Occult America, The Secret History of How Mysticism Shaped Our Nation. If you want to join the conversation, give us a call at 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU NPR News.
Good morning. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News. 55 degrees in downtown Columbus. And at 1 o'clock, On Point will be here. Asian countries pour money and resources into higher education while American universities go begging. On Point discusses higher education in America. That's at 1 o'clock, right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. Enjoy more of WOSU anytime at WOSU.org. Spend your day with the beauty of classical music by streaming on the web. Listen anywhere in the world from the convenience of your computer. Tune in online at WOSU.org. In the weather forecast for today, sunshine this afternoon, a high of 65 degrees, a few clouds tonight, but the chance of rain is only after midnight, a low of 53. And cloudy skies for Friday with a chance of rain showers and a high of 68 degrees. And now back to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Okay, that is from Appalachian Spring by Aaron Copeland. It is a take on the Shaker hymn, Simple Gifts. You are listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Today we are talking with Mitch Horowitz. He is the author of Occult America, The Secret History of How Mysticism Shaped Our Nation. Mitch, it's a very interesting chapter on the Shakers.
Yes, and that's a great selection of music that you chose. The Shakers talked about receiving these musical gifts from the spirit world. That's something that one doesn't hear much about when visiting some of these beautifully preserved Shaker villages. But right. The Shakers were very interested in what we might call spiritualism or mediumship. They would hold veritable seances, and they would have communiques from the spirit world, which would translate into hymns, something like the one you just played, into paintings. They would dance, they would shout, they would describe being possessed by divine spirits. And actually, the Shakers are thought of as an American movement, but they are a migrant movement from Great Britain, because they were known as the Shaking Quakers.
I know. I got to tell you, that really caught me off guard. Ignorance. A picture Shakers is very reserved and furniture makers.
Right, right. That's the popular notion. But their past is actually much more raucous and unusual. And they are part of occult history in the sense that when the Shakers became public in Manchester, England, in the late 1700s, they were accused of sorcery. They were engaged in things like speaking in tongues, transmediumship, communicating with the dead. They would engage in these really ecstatic forms of worship where they might roll around on the floor, jump and shout. And they came under a lot of hostility, and they were jailed and physically harassed in the town of Manchester, England, until the year 1774, when a young woman named Anne Lee, who had become more or less their spiritual leader, had a vision that the Shakers needed to uproot themselves from Manchester, travel across the Atlantic to the New World of America, where this vision told her they would be able to flourish. And sure enough, she sailed across the Atlantic in 1774, reached New York City with a handful of followers. She and her followers worked at just menial jobs in New York City, and they managed to scrape together enough money to buy a plot of land outside Albany, New York, which is in New York's Hudson Valley region, in the year 1776. They put together a colony there. It looked nothing like the preserved Shaker villages that we have today. There were no nice, tidy meeting houses or well-kept yards or beautifully produced furniture. It was a hard scrabble existence, but they did survive, and they grew, and different members came to them, and they were considered very much a supernatural movement. Anne Lee used to say, "We are the people who turn the world upside down." She was a very mysterious figure, and their villages spread throughout the country, and people visited them. It got the young republic acclimated to the idea that religious experiments could take root and succeed on American soil.
And they attracted followers from outside of their group.
That's right. You know, for a little while there, they were really a migrant movement. They were a British movement, and they were regarded with great suspicion because they were pacifists. They didn't fight
right
in the War of Independence, and the colonial government thought they were spies. But eventually, you know, in the turning of a generation, they became a very popular and widely known mystical movement.
There is the person who called herself the Universal Friend.
Right.
Very, very interesting story there.
Yeah. One of my favorite figures in the book, the Public Universal Friend.
The Public Universal Friend,
yeah,
I'm sorry.
She was a trance medium who essentially became America's first female religious leader, again in the year 1776. Her given name was Jemima Wilkinson, and Jemima was a young woman who grew up on a prosperous Quaker farm in the town of Cumberland, Rhode Island. And that area of New England was swept by a religious revival that was called the Great Awakening. And Jemima converted from Quakerism to a kind of fervent form of baptism, and she used to just pore over the Bible. In the year 1776, she got sick with typhus fever. She went to her bed. She slipped into a coma, and she was in a coma and suffering a great fever for days, and her family was sure that she was going to die, just like so many people in the region did. A few days later, she leaps up from her bed, her cheeks just flush with redness, and she's still kind of skinny and emaciated from her fever. And she announces to her family that the girl they knew as Jemima Wilkinson has died, has gone to the spirit world. And the being standing before them was actually animated by some kind of a divine spirit from the afterlife and would answer only to the name Public Universal Friend. And the Public Universal Friend began traveling around the New England area, New York, down to Philly, delivering sermons and lectures and homilies on religious topics. And most of her subjects were pretty tame. You know, they were really
pedestrian do-gooder stuff.
Yeah, very ordinary stuff, you know, about the virtues of punctuality, do unto others ethics, the golden rule. But And in contrast, her claims about herself were fantastic. She described herself as a supernatural being who was reanimated by a divine spirit. And this became America's first female religious leader. She was written about in the press, and when people saw her, it was the very first time that any of them, for the most part, had seen a woman deliver a sermon or a homily in public. Again and again, you find this pattern in America where occult or supernatural religious movements are also creating political openings. In that sense, a certain kind of political liberalism grew up hand in hand with avant-garde religious movements in America.
Well, she underscores the notion that you made early on about how the occult took a different path from its European predecessors and toward the public good and self-help.
That's right. American occultists were always interested in evangelizing. The idea was always to spread the message. The Europeans were in love with secret lodges and secret societies and organizations and initiatory ranks. You know, the American occult looked nothing like that. It came in the form of the Shakers, in the form of the Public Universal Friend, in the form of spiritualists who started newspapers and mail order courses and clubs and societies. You know, American occultism had this do-it-yourself ethos, and it wanted to sign everybody up. It wanted to enlist everyone in these ideas.
You know, when at the beginning of the book, when you describe your first, you know, that time in the restaurant when you were a kid in Queens,
yeah.
And and those rolled up, those scrolls of horoscopes, you know, kind of
yeah.
Correct you. I thought, to talk about the lowest common denominator.
Right.
Some kids wandering up to this machine
right.
in some diner in Queens.
Right. I was a 9-year-old kid, and there was a horoscope machine on a countertop in a diner in Queens. And I'll never forget it. For a dime, you could buy this little star scroll. And, you know, the whole thing, you could probably still find these things out there today.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, there was an American astrologer. Some of your listeners may remember him. He went by the name of Zolar. His name was actually Bruce King, and he was a clothing salesman from New York City, but a very interesting and learned guy. He was the one who invented the dime horoscope machine, among many
others. It's like kind of the Model T of
exactly.
the horoscope, you know?
Exactly.
or the chicken in every pot. Everybody can have a horoscope.
Right. Zolar got his first breakout in 1934 when the dime store chain Woolworth, which is unfortunately no longer with us, but talk about an emporium of the occult.
Yeah.
Woolworths decided that they would stock Zolar's daily horoscope guides on their, you know, at their book counters, and that was just a huge breakthrough. He, as you said, you know, he set the template for this whole modern wave in self-help and daily horoscope astrology.
I'll never forget when I found a horoscope a box of matchbooks with the horoscopes on them. And I found the Libra one, and I can still remember the little poem that was printed on it. I don't know why that's so imprinted on my brain.
It was probably written by Zolar.
It was made me sound really good. That's all.
Yeah,
it probably was. There was a horoscope. Who was the woman you said she was a Miss America pageant?
Oh, Linda Goodman.
Linda Goodman, yeah.
Yeah. She was she in the late 1960s, Linda Goodman produced a book called Sun Sign.
Yeah.
And it became the first work of astrology to appear on the New York Times bestseller list. And that was the book that for a while got everybody asking, what's your sign, as a pickup line? That was Linda Goodman, and she was a former Miss America. Her life took really very, very tragic turns. Some years after that, she had a daughter who committed suicide, and she could never come to grips with it. And she had made so much money through her astrology books, but at one point she was actually living on the streets, and she suffered through some terrible, terrible times. But that was a happy time in her life in 1969 when she produced the book Sun Signs. She was the one, probably more than anyone else since Zolar, who popularized astrology in the U.S.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I am speaking with Mitch Horowitz. He is the author of Occult America, The Secret History of How Mysticism Shaped Our Nation. This is a great sort of a beggar's night topic, but it's interesting anyway. If you would like to join the conversation, call 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Again, the number 614-292-8513. 8513. Ken Burns, in his review of the book, notes that your history book is not about the, quote, grand procession of presidents generals and wars, but something more hidden, more mysterious, but often no less revealing. Mitch, how difficult was it to research for this book, given the hidden nature of so many of these elements?
Oh, that's a wonderful question. You know, one of the great challenges in the research was that very little of real quality has been written on many of these topics. So there's a lot of hearsay, there's a lot of inaccuracies, and just about every piece of source material that I used had to be checked and rechecked against, you know, two other pieces of source material to ensure that I was getting at something accurately, because I wanted to provide a book that would not only be fun to read, but that would be a resource for other people who wanted to research these topics. And there's a real dearth of quality material on a lot of these subjects. So there was a lot of checking and cross-checking and references. And of course, you also have to form personal relationships with some of the organizations that were left behind by some of these individuals. And in certain cases, those organizations have been out of public view for so long that they are at times a little bit cagey or suspicious. And, you know, there's a task there of not only winning people's trust, but winning it for the right reasons, showing that the intention was to write a serious book on these figures, not some kind of a hit-and-run job.
Right. You talk about, I think the public universal friend came from this area, but certainly Ann Lee was in from the Burned Over District. Am I wrong about that, or are they both from that area?
Oh, you're correct.
Tell us about that.
Yeah. The Burned Over District was a strip of land in central New York State. It was called that because it was considered burned over by the fires of religious passion. It's this area that extends about 300 miles plus between the city of Albany in the east and the city of Buffalo in the west. In the early 19th century, this was the Mount Sinai of American mysticism. This was the great laboratory where so many of our avant-garde or new religious movements sprang from in the first part of the 19th century. That includes Mormonism, Spiritualism, Seventh-day Adventism, and also political movements like the Women's Rights Movement, for example. The first Women's Rights Convention was held in this region. It was this very unusual area that had been occupied, that had been home to the Iroquois tribe, the Iroquois Nation, in the days of colonial America. After the War of Independence, the new government pushed the Iroquois off this land in central New York State and opened it to settlement. So it became this place where this wave of relatively liberal New Englanders started to flow into. Some of them stayed there because of the rich farmland, and some of them used the place as kind of a great highway or artery to travel westward and settle the rest of the nation. And so you had this just mass of relatively liberal new migrants there, and they attracted every kind of itinerant minister or religious impresario or personality who was looking for a congregation. And for several generations, just an amazing wave of occult and esoteric religious movements and radical political movements grew out of this burned over district in central New York State. If you follow migration patterns in America, you can really piece together its religious history, because wherever you have new flows of population, you have new religions. So this occurred in New York State in the early 19th century, and then it reoccurred in California, where it's still playing out, starting in the early 20th century.
And where in California? Any place particular? Or?
Oh, just everywhere.
Okay.
You know, California was experiencing boom times in the 19-teens, and again, there was just this flow of migrants from all across the nation to California and San Francisco and Los Angeles and all points in between, again, you know, just became this kind of springboard for New Age and alternative religions.
You know, I was surprised to learn that numerology was the brainchild of an early 20th century American homemaker.
Yes.
I would have thought it was much older. I guess there's something about this movement, if you want to kind of generalize and call it that, that accepts newness.
It's very interesting. Accepts newness and sometimes brands it as being very old, you know.
Yes.
We Americans, we like new ideas, but no sooner do we embrace them than we look to the distant past to confirm them, you know. And we like the notion that our new ideas were being practiced by the ancients. And, you know, sometimes those threads are there, and sometimes there's a little bit of imagination going on. Numerology is one such movement. You know, that term seems like it's always been with us, but it only began to be, you know, first of all, the term didn't even appear in English until around the 1870s, from the best I can tell, and it didn't have any occult associations until the 1920s. There was a writer and a homemaker and a civic activist named Sarah Balliette, who lived in Atlantic City, New Jersey, the resort town of Atlantic City in the 19-teens. And she created a number system for divining your personality or determining how your birth date might influence various aspects of your life. And this is the system that eventually got called numerology. It was very American. You know, she was a person who understood that the ancient Greeks and the ancient Hebrews corresponded numbers to the characters of their individual alphabets. But we English-speaking folk had no such system. So using some ersatz, Pythagorean mathematics, and some of her own imagination, she came up with a system to apply numbers to English letters. And that's the system that's used everywhere today, and we call it numerology. Came from Atlantic City, New Jersey in the 19-teens.
And that's how people make something of your name.
That's right. They take your name, they reduce it to a number. They take your birth date, they reduce it to a number, or even the street where you live. And there are many people who practice this system with great seriousness. And I say, you know, God bless them. I mean, we find all kinds of ways of trying to make sense of our existence, and some of them are very new. That's a system whose roots in this country are new.
Let's take our break now. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News. We'll be right back with Mitch Horowitz, the author of Occult America, The Secret History of How Mysticism Shaped Our Nation. We'll be right back.
Corporate partners help provide support for WOSU 820. Your business can join them and reach an educated, engaged, appreciative audience every day. Your business will also be associated with a trusted source for national and local news, arts, and culture. For more information, contact Christine Schottich at 247-4469. And thanks for supporting WOSU 820, NPR News.
In just about 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, hour two of All Sides with Ann Fisher will be here. We'll hear about State Issue 1, a proposed amendment to the Ohio Constitution to provide a bonus to veterans of the Persian Gulf, Afghanistan, and Iraq conflicts. And we'll hear an overview of benefits and services available to veterans in Central Ohio and the state of Ohio. That discussion begins at 11 o'clock on All Sides with Ann Fisher, right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. Currently 56 degrees in downtown Columbus. Some sunshine should peek through those clouds later this afternoon, a high of 65. A few clouds move in tonight and a chance of rain after midnight, but it looks like Beggar's Night will be pretty nice, a low of 53 degrees. For Friday, cloudy skies with a 50% chance of rain and a high of 68. And now back to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
That is, of course, the song "The Age of Aquarius." It's from the musical Hair. It's the movie version. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News, and I am speaking today with Mitch Horowitz. He's the author of Occult America, The Secret History of How Mysticism Shaped Our Nation, and The Age of Aquarius is part of that story, and also the voice of a woman. One thing I haven't brought up yet, but the female voice is very strong in the occult and the mysticism movement.
Yeah, uniquely so. You know, when the spiritualist movement began in this country, and it can be dated to the year 1848 outside of Rochester, New York, this was a city right in the center of the burned-over district, it was the work of two teenage girls, Kate and Margaret Fox. They told their Methodist parents that these noise and raps that were being heard throughout their small cabin were spirit raps, and these girls said they were able to communicate with the afterworld. And Americans got very aroused by this because for a period of time, and I think this still continues, Americans were in love with the idea that ordinary folks just ordinary, uneducated people, even kids, could participate in some way in a dialogue with the divine or the afterworld. This was a very American concept. It was a kind of radical Protestantism. People felt this entitlement that they needed no intermediary. And this found its most radical expression in the occult. And when the spiritualist movement became popular and it caught fire almost right away for a variety of reasons, most of the spirit mediums, most of the trance mediums in this country, and the people who were sitting at seance tables presiding over these things were women. Spiritualism, in effect, became the first modern movement in which women could serve as religious leaders, at least of a sort, and women who were looking to have some kind of a voice in the civic or religious life of the country just flocked into spiritualism. This also helped ignite the women's voting rights movement. The first women's voting rights movement was held in Seneca Falls, New York, again in the burned over district, in 1848, same year as spiritualism. That was no accident. These two movements kind of grew as branches from the same tree. For a generation at least in the 19th century, you could not find a voting rights activist, a suffragette activist, who hadn't spent some time at the seance table, and vice versa. The two movements totally overlapped for a period of time.
What about the seance craze? It was, what is the word I'm looking for? It was debunked,
yeah.
In large part publicly.
Right.
What were the roots of that, and then how did it end?
You know, the roots of it really, and in a sense it hasn't ended,
yeah.
Because now we call it by different names, you know, channeling and
right.
psychics and so forth. So, you know, we always rename things in America, but nothing ever ends.
The Shaka Puddin did, but go on.
Right, that's true. The spiritualist movement was really born out of the thirst for a kind of a therapeutic spirituality in this country. You had just an enormous infant and childhood mortality rate. Not a family in America that had kids had not been touched by the tragedy of losing a child or more to so many of the childhood diseases that were rife in this country in the mid-19th century. And these people, and very often it was women who suffered the brunt of it because they were the ones in the homes. They were the ones who had to stand by the empty cribs and be reminded of these deaths every day. There was no therapy, obviously. There was no pastoral counseling. There were nothing like support groups. None of this existed within Calvinist Protestantism. And suddenly here comes a movement that says you can contact your loved ones. And people flocked to the seance tables because they were seeking relief from this tragedy just hung over life. And you can find in the letters and diaries of so many educated folks from that era stories of them experiencing some of the most moving moments of their lives at the seance table. So whatever it is that was going on there, you call it fantasy, psychology, faith, you know, people were experiencing something cathartic. Now, as with all movements, when things sort of spread and go local, they get mixed up with commerce. And by the 1870s, you had a lot of trance mediums who were just kind of doing this for money, and it was all just hocus pocus and stage magic. And a lot of people began to expose this, including Harry Houdini, famously,
right.
in the 1920s. So the movement as a religious movement, as an overtly church-based religious movement, and it did have its own network of churches, it began to decline in the late 19th, early 20th century. Although remnants of that movement still exist, you still have spiritualist churches and towns in various parts of the United States. But what was being sought in that movement, it simply went elsewhere. And we now today call it channeling, which is popular all over America. There are channeled books, so-called, on the bestseller list. And you find people in towns and cities all across the country forming themselves into healing circles around an individual channeler. So it's the same impulse and it's the same movement, actually.
Just a different environment, I guess. Is it
yep.
John Edward?
Oh, he's certainly one of them. Absolutely.
Yeah, and yep. you know, there yep. he's in us with a studio audience and it's brightly lit. And
Yeah, and
the whole deal, and lots of laughing, and
that's right.
When it's not extremely serious, but he. So I guess that's it was sort of that environment of the seance, the dark room, the flickering candles, that kind of thing, seems to have come to an end.
Yeah, that by and large has come to an end. You can still find it. I mean, there are still spiritualist churches where you can engage in seance circles. But it's funny. I was speaking with a columnist from the Washington Times, and she and I were laughing that ultimately in America, every supernatural or religious expression in the end, winds up looking like a business motivational seminar. You know, it's always brightly lit, and there's an audience, and there's applause, and so on and so forth. That's a very American thing. But,
big church.
Right, big box, exactly.
Church.
But if you look at, you know, the people are standing on the shoulders of these earlier occult movements in so many of these popular manifestations.
Was it about the time during the same time as the seance became so popularized in the mid-19th century that the Ouija board appeared?
Shortly after.
Okay. How'd that come about?
It's funny. American spiritualists, they were just like Americans everywhere. They had this do-it-yourself ethos, and they always wanted to find better and more efficient and more effective ways of getting things done. In this case, talking to the dead. So American spiritualists who got bored with seances or didn't even want to use a trance medium as some kind of an intermediary, they began experimenting with different devices. And one of these devices was called an alphabet board or a talking board. And it looked exactly like what we call the Ouija board today. You can see these developments going on in the 1850s. And the earliest reference I've found to what we call a Ouija board is from a New York City newspaper in 1886, where they wrote an article about these talking boards that were being used in the state of Ohio, and that were Ohio is the birthplace, as far as I'm concerned, of the talking board or the Ouija board. And I'll stand on those words,
okay.
Yeah, because they're
Etch-a-Sketch too. Okay, go on. Etch-a-Sketch as well, but go
Etch-a-Sketch
on.
Etch-a-Sketch as well. Well, there you go. It was a homemade object among Ohio spiritualists. You know, folks would just use a carving knife and an ink brush, and they would create this talking board that's the spitting image, more or less, of what we call a Ouija board today. So this object from folklore was circulating through the hands of spiritualists at home, and they would move this little table or planchette around the board with the idea that they were spelling out messages from the spirit world. A few years later, a group of novelty manufacturers in the city of Baltimore actually managed to get a patent on the thing, and they called it a Ouija board, and they trademarked it, and they sold it as a toy, and ever since then, it just became one of the most popular, strangest novelty items in the country. You know, I mean, the fact that it's a toy makes it all the more creepy, like those weird talking dolls that you used to see on the Twilight Zone.
Well, yeah, exactly.
Everyone has a scary Ouija story.
Why Ouija? What the heck does Ouija mean?
Oh, gosh. You know, if you ask anybody, you know, any one person has three different opinions about it. The founders themselves couldn't even agree on where the name came from. You know, some people said, oh, it's Egyptian for good luck, or, you know, the board named itself during a Ouija session. That's my favorite. But you know, all the folks who held the original patent had a whole range of different stories, and they couldn't agree themselves.
This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News. If you would like to join the conversation with Mitch Horowitz, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We still have a few minutes to go. At the outset, I mentioned that mysticism does have a connection with Halloween. And how we celebrate it, and in the spirit of it is beggar's night here. We never seem to do it on the right night, at least. But it is going to be beautiful tonight, so that's good. But tell us, what's the connection?
Well, you know, what we call Halloween is actually an ancient Celtic holiday, a pre-Christian Celtic holiday that used to mark the onset of winter and was a period where you would not only bring in the cattle from the fields and sort of hunker down for a long winter, but you would welcome the ghosts of your ancestors to sit with you by a bonfire or a hearth fire. And eventually in late antiquity, as in so many cases, that ancient pagan holiday got bound up with a Christian church-based holiday, All Souls Day, and the two wound up getting conflated. So, you know, depending on which calendar you look at, you're either celebrating Swain, which is the ancient Celtic version of the holiday, Halloween, which is the American version, which really hasn't been around in its current form for that long. Trick-or-treating probably only goes back to about World War II. Or if you look at a Christian calendar, you're celebrating All Saints Day. And this is how it goes with holidays in the West. You know, one thing builds on another. Everything comes from someplace, and then all these other things get attached and conflated with it. Something to watch for with Halloween, people always ask me about different spiritual trends. Watch for this spiritual trend. Halloween is becoming more and more serious as a religious holiday among people who practice what is called Wicca or neo-paganism. These are religions that are sometimes called witchcraft. You know, this Halloween, which we just associate with kid stuff, is actually becoming more and more of a veritable religious tradition to people who celebrate Wicca, and they're reaching backwards and trying to better understand how the faith was practiced among the ancient Celts.
Okay, we've got a call from Diane. She wants to know about Lilydale, New York. Diane, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. Didn't know if you had already talked about this or not, but about 22 years ago, I went, I'm pretty sure it's called Lilydale.
That's right, yes.
Okay. I just wondered what its roots were.
Lilydale has been around and in continuous operation since the 1870s. It is a spiritualist town in upstate New York near the city of Buffalo. It's actually closer to the Midwest than it is to New York City. There are two surviving spiritualist towns in America. Lilydale is one, and the other is called Casadega in Florida. These are basically towns whose streets are lined with people who practice transmediumship. Lilydale is more of a seasonal community. There are year-round residents, but visitors will come in the summer. They might spend their vacations there. They might spend a few days there, and they will frequent these various trance mediums. This was a very popular thing in America in the late 19th century. There were different towns and summer camps and resort communities that were spiritualist in nature, just as there are Christian towns and summer communities that people will flock to today. Spiritualism was a religious movement, and in some respects still is. It still has a network of churches, and there are a few of these towns still surviving. This is 19th century spiritualism, in essence, and these are the carryovers of it into the 21st.
Diane, what did you find when you visited Lilydale?
Well, it was actually really interesting. One of the things I remember doing was a future life progression, and I remember seeing that I was Gloria Allred, the attorney, who's very famous now and who was not back then, and she was as Gloria, speaking at the Ohio State University out in front of one of the buildings to just masses of people. And I thought it was very interesting, especially since ultimately I ended up teaching at the Ohio State University.
Okay.
But I'm not Gloria Allred.
All righty. Thanks for calling, Diane.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. You know, I wanted, before the show's over with, I definitely wanted to get to Edgar Cayce, probably one of the most fascinating figures ever in American spiritualism. He's considered a true prophet on many levels. So could you tell us about him and what we need to know about Edgar Cayce?
You know, he's considered the grandfather of the New Age. He's probably one of the most influential religious figures in recent American history. Cayce was what would be called a channeler. He was the one who first used the word channel in a spiritual sense. He was considered a medical clairvoyant. In the late 19th and the first half of the 20th century, Cayce, who was born in the deep backwoods of Kentucky, lived in the environs of the Bible Belt his entire life, was in fact a Sunday school teacher at a Disciples of Christ church, a conservative Christian. Cayce would go into a kind of a trance state from which his followers said he could diagnose the illnesses and diseases of people that he had never met, and he could prescribe cures for these people. And there are case files that show thousands and thousands of people who did in fact report receiving cures in this way. They're all anecdotal, but you can go and you can read these case files where Cayce conducted these trance readings, and people would come back to him again and again and again claiming that he alone had successfully healed them of a disease or an ailment or of a pain. And Cayce, as his life continued into the 20th century, began to give trance readings to people of a psychological sort. He would analyze people's neuroses. He would talk about their having past lives, their having been reincarnated, and some present-day neuroses were the result of something that had happened to them in the distant past. And through his trance readings, Cayce would use words like reincarnation, karma, channeler, clairvoyance, psychic. These were things that most Americans had not heard of at all before the Second World War, and today they're household terms. There's almost no one who doesn't know something about karma or reincarnation or ESP and perhaps have an opinion about these things.
Mm-hmm.
That's largely due to the influence of Edgar Cayce.
And most people don't really know who he is. He's not that well known outside of the community.
That's right. And this is an interesting facet of religion in America. You know, we all know what reincarnation is and might even have an opinion about it. But the person who popularized the term and the idea in our culture gets forgotten. And he was a fascinating guy, Cayce. He died just at the end of the Second World War, and he did attain a certain fame, but it's really his influence throughout the culture that's better known than his name. And you know, he also did a great deal to help instigate the culture of alternative medicine that
right.
you find in our country today. He was the first one who prescribed meditation for stress-relieving purposes, for therapeutic purposes. That was in the 1930s.
And, of course, as with most things, he had an Ohio connection.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. He had patrons from Ohio. Is that what you're referring to?
In Dayton, Ohio.
In Dayton, Ohio. That's right. That's right. Cayce had, there was a man named Arthur Lammers, who was a wealthy printer who lived in Dayton, Ohio. Lammers, and I write about this in the book, was the first person who approached Cayce and said, you know what, maybe you can use these medical readings of yours for broader purposes. Maybe you can go into a trance state and look into the past, look into the future, ask religious questions, ask questions about the truth of different mystery religions and systems like astrology or numerology. Do these things work? Where do they come from? So it was really this man from Dayton, Ohio, Arthur Lammers, who encouraged Cayce to start expanding the spiritual content of his readings. And again, that too was a kind of tremendous opening for some of the ideas and terms and language that today we associate with the New Age.
Okay, let's take another call. Rachel, you're on the air. You want to talk about State House Haunted Tours? Make that quick, but then you have a question too about the Ouija board.
Actually, no. I just portrayed Victoria Woodhull at the State House Haunted Tours using my Ouija board. And I just heard the tail end of this whole program, so I don't know, maybe you already mentioned it, but the discussion of where the name came from, I always figured it was just we from French and ya from German, so that it made it more appealing to, you know, many of the people in the Ohio country, maybe.
Right, right. That's a theory that's certainly out there. You know, I mentioned that in the book. That's certainly one of the ideas that's been out there.
Okay. What's the name of the book, please? I didn't hear
it. It is called Occult America, The Secret History of How Mysticism Shaped Our Nation, and you're speaking with Mitch Horowitz. Rachel, are those haunted tours still going on?
No.
Okay.
They were sold out from the very beginning, so they weren't really promoted after. But get in early for next year.
Maybe next year. Thanks for calling, Rachel.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye. Okay. Let's see. Do I have any more? I may have any more questions? We can get an answer in 30 seconds. Can you quickly the
I like a challenge.
Tell us about Henry A. Wallace, FDR's second vice president.
He was FDR's second vice president, a name that's been forgotten.
Less than a minute. Okay.
But he was a true journeyer in occult and esoteric belief systems, and it's Henry A. Wallace who's responsible for that mysterious eye and pyramid that appears on the back of our dollar bill. We carry it around every day, and it's thanks to Wallace. I write about him and the meaning of that eye and pyramid in the book.
Okay, and that book is called Occult America, The Secret History of How Mysticism Shaped Our Nation. I've been speaking with Mitch Horowitz, the author of that book. Mitch, thank you so much. I had a lot of fun.
Thank you. Very interesting.
Okay, this is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.